Science is Under-Understood.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Billy.
Hello, Billy.
Good evening.
Oh, Red, you okay?
I just have a cold.
Oh, okay.
I think this is like my radio voice, though.
I love it.
It's nice. It's
sounds good.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, everybody.
As you all know, we've been trying a bunch of new segments on the show. Everyone is loving the new segments.
Except for Sexy Luigi.
Well, yeah, except one person on Twitter who insisted that we can't call something a segment if it takes up the entirety of an episode.
But it doesn't, because it doesn't take up the credits.
Well, and also, like, respectfully, who's to decide what the segment is a segment of?
Yeah, it could be a segment of the entire series.
Yeah, everything's relative, man.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, whatever.
Are you telling us that you're about to do a new segment?
Yes. How did you guess?
Thank God.
And you bet it's going to take up the whole episode. The new segment is called News We Can Use.
News We Can Use. Is this like service journalism?
Yeah. Are we getting servicey?
Well, you know, we're not normally a topical show. We don't really talk about the news directly.
No.
If you want to hear about the headlines of the day, there are plenty of other podcasts you can tune into.
I like Up First.
Sure, listen to Up First. But I often find buried inside of big zeitgeisty stories, there are little details that are worth expanding on. And I was reading about the writer's strike.
Mm.
Are you all familiar with the Writers Guild of America going on strike?
Very.
Yes.
Yes, but vaguely.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, these people, they're the people who craft the foundation of, you know, the best American film and television. And as I was reading an article about the strike in the New Yorker.
I like that pause as if we were supposed to react that you, you read the New Yorker.
I was just reading the New Yorker.
Do you also have a tote bag?
No, sorry. I was just actually trying to remember when I had read it. And this was actually like right before the strike started. So that context is important.
Uh-huh. Okay. So WGA, Writers Guild of America, they're striking. What are they striking for, basically?
To not treat writers of TV shows like gig workers.
Yeah.
For the first time in 15 years, over 11,000 TV and movie writers have gone on strike.
Here's Amy Goodman summarizing it on Democracy Now!
In a statement, the Writers Guild of America said writers are facing a, quote, existential crisis, in part because pay and working conditions have deteriorated in recent years due to the rise of streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime. The union said, quote, the company's behavior has created a gig economy inside a union workforce, and their immovable stance in this negotiation has betrayed a commitment to further devaluing the profession of writing. Unquote.
The Writers Guild is basically saying that their writers are suffering the same fate as so many workforces in this country. They've been commodified and forced to work gig to gig for scraps. But unlike many of those industries, they have a long-standing, powerful union. And so after a period of trying to get the studios to negotiate with them in good faith, to no avail, they've decided to exercise the full power of their union by withholding their labor.
Last month, 98% of the members of the Writers Guild voted in favor of this strike.
And a lot of the specific demands are things you'd traditionally see in an entertainment industry strike. Stuff like higher minimum fees, updated terms for residuals, largely driven by the streaming model for production not applying to many of their previously negotiated terms.
We want to make sure that writers are paid the same in streaming as they are on television.
This is Adam Conover of Adam Ruins Everything talking to CNN.
My first show was for True TV. My second show was for Netflix. The show had the exact same format, but on Netflix, we had no minimums, we had no protections, we were paid less. The residuals are literally 1% of what they were under broadcast. And that's true for everybody in late night. That's true for screenwriters. It's true across all of our work areas.
In addition to that, though, there is some more forward-thinking stuff, like setting rules and guardrails around how the industry can use stuff like generative AI and large language models to essentially generate scripts without writers.
Studio executives have been outspoken and come right out and said they believe that we'll have the first AI-generated script within a year.
This is reporter Megan Cerullo talking on CBS News.
So that's why there are three protections that writers want in place. They don't want AI to be used to write or rewrite any scripts. They don't want to have to rewrite what some of them call trash generated by AI.
Yeah.
And they don't want studios to be able to train AI on their work. So they don't want studios to give AI a prompt. Say, write a script in the style of this very successful
Seinfeld.
Hollywood writer,
right.
Which AI has shown it has the capability to do.
Yeah, so far not very good, though, mm-hmm. But you never know what the future holds.
They talk about it in this article. This article is titled, Why Are TV Writers So Miserable?
Yeah.
And they talk about that, and the AI stuff is super interesting. I think it's important that they're fighting that fight. But there's another detail of something that the writers are pushing back against, and it's not getting quite as much attention. It's something called mini rooms.
Mm. Oh.
Have any of you heard of these?
I think it refers to a mini writer's room.
Yeah.
Like a hackathon?
It is sort of like a hackathon for writing. Here's how they talk about it in that New Yorker piece. It says, one point of contention in the WGA negotiations has been mini rooms, condensed writers' rooms that often take place before a show is greenlighted. Mini rooms give studio proof of concept while saving money, but they force writers to spread paltrier fees over longer gaps, working for shows that may or may not get made.
Mm.
So in this article, they talk to Janine Neighbors, who is an accomplished writer who is showrunner for Swarm, which he co-created with Donald Glover. Mm. She's quoted saying, what you start to realize is that there is no advancing forward because you're constantly in these rooms where you're being paid at a minimum. If your contract ends and the show's not going to be made for another year, all of your work could just be erased. And not a lot of people were talking about this at first, but it started to gain some traction. George R.R. Martin, who people obviously know is the writer behind Game of Thrones, he tweeted, quote, I want to say a few words about what I think is the most important issue in the current writer's strike. And he linked to a blog post where he talks about his experience getting to work on the 80s revival of The Twilight Zone, and how even as a junior writer without any Hollywood experience, he got to be involved in basically all aspects of the production, all of which he says was necessary to get to the point where he was able to adapt his writing into the HBO show Game of Thrones, you know, one of the most successful television shows of all time. This is the essential thing about mini rooms. You're not part of the staff. You're hired for a very temporary amount of time to do something that is very disposable. You're hired with a small team to write a whole season of a show that may or may not be used. And that's increasingly becoming common practice.
They really use the scripts created by the mini room? They're not just proof of concept scripts?
No, they're actually making full seasons of shows, and they use those full seasons of shows. It's basically like your hackathon metaphor, where the studios are like, okay, let's just put a small group of writers under extreme conditions in a very short period of time and see what happens. And if we think it's usable, we'll put it out. If it's not something we want to put out right now, we'll lock it away. And writers say this is increasingly the model that they're subjected to in this streaming era of film and television.
Okay.
Adam Conover actually talked about this in that CNN clip. Let me just play a little bit of that again.
So the studios are trying to eliminate the writer's room. You're probably familiar with the term, the writer's room. This is a room that's existed for decades where writers get together and break a story and write scripts. The companies are trying to eliminate it. They're trying to make the room smaller. They're trying to employ us on a freelance basis. They'd rather we just stay home and email scripts in and they pay us a fee every once in a while. And we can't make a living that way. And so our proposals are to ensure that there's a writer's room on every single show, and they have refused to even discuss that proposal with us.
The big thing I think is missing in this conversation is what's missing. Like, what are we missing out on? Janine Neighbors said, you could be hired to work in a mini room only to find out later that all of your work has been erased. Or I would assume blocked away somewhere.
Oh.
And we talk a lot about missing media on this show.
Open the vaults.
Yeah. How can we open the vaults?
Okay, wait. Wait. Is it possible that we're about to really understand what's in that missing media vault when all of the production studios turn to all of this discarded stuff during the writer's strike to produce instead?
Yes, absolutely. That is not a wild conspiracy theory.
No.
That is what many writers out on the picket lines are saying, is that they feel like much of their work may have been filed away so that these companies could withstand a writer's strike, which they anticipated being sort of inevitable the way they were running things.
Wow, really?
That's awful.
And there was one other thing that stood out to me about that New Yorker article. Did I mention I was reading the New Yorker when I... The other thing that stood out to me in the New Yorker article is that I actually know one of the writers who the rest of the piece was sort of framed around.
Oh.
Is it Alex O'Keefe?
Yes. It's a friend of mine, former guest on the show, Alex O'Keefe.
I heard him on another podcast talking about it.
You heard him on another podcast? What podcast was it?
Oh, good question.
I can't believe he's podcast cheating on us.
No, it was Up First.
Oh, on Up First. Well,
great podcast.
Like I said, if you want to hear about the news, listen to Up First. They'll probably do it first. But we might have a slightly different angle with literally the same person.
It was a very quick bite.
It's wild. So I was like talking to a friend about this in the back of a cab the other day, and we were talking about the writer's strike, and I was like, just go on Google News and search for news about the writer's strike. And I guarantee you, you'll see my friend Alex. And they did it, and literally like four of the first five articles or something featured quotes from him, or the lead image was like his face real big on the article.
How did this happen?
Well, he's a writer on a show that has some acclaim.
What show is he a writer on?
The Bear.
The Bear.
The Bear, yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Very good show.
Yeah. So here's reading again from The New Yorker. Here's what it says. For newer writers, there's a sense of having shown up to the party too late. Alex O'Keefe, who is 28, grew up poor in Florida and worked as a speechwriter for the Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey, and as Green New Deal campaign director before getting staffed on FX's The Bear. Quote, it should have been this beautiful rags-to-riches story, right? He told me. Unfortunately, I realized not all that glitters is gold.
Alex, you don't need those cliches. I thought you were a writer.
Oh, no. He knows when and where to land them. That's the writing secret. Okay, I'm just giving you an excerpt.
Okay.
It was the transition that The New Yorker needed. That's why he's in all of these
articles.
Yeah,
this is why he gets quoted in everything. He knows exactly what he's doing.
So when we get back from the break, we'll talk to Alex. We'll talk to him about breaking into the industry, how that happened, the challenges he faced working in various mini rooms, and what was lost along the way.
I forgot what the segment is.
It's news we can use.
Oh, right. Yes, okay. Hi, Hi, listener. Adrienne here. Underunderstood is an independent production, made in our spare time because we love to do it. We're able to do it because of the generous support of listeners on Patreon. Underunderstood patrons make it possible for us to license music, publish transcripts, access research tools, buy software, and now even pay an editor to help us make the show better. We now have two tiers on our Patreon. $3 a month gets you access to our awesome Discord community and a monthly live stream. $5 a month gets you all of that, plus a podcast feed containing our extensive back catalog of bonus episodes and new recordings of the live streams, and maybe some other extras. Both tiers help keep the show sustainable and ad-free, plus you get to join a very cool group of people who hang out together online. For those of you who are already patrons or have ever been a patron, we can't thank you enough. If you'd like to join, go to patreon.com/underunderstood. One more thing. We have a voicemail box now where listeners can leave messages and ask us to solve mysteries. The number is 212-994-4882. Seriously, leave us a message. We want to hear from you. Again, that number is 212-994-4882. Now back to the show.
Okay, we're back.
Hello.
Hi.
We were talking about this idea of mini rooms, and I mentioned Alex O'Keefe. He's participated in a few of these so-called mini rooms. One of them produced a huge hit, The Bear, on FX, a show about a sandwich shop in Chicago, starring Jeremy Allen White.
That's so cool that Alex writes for that. I love that show.
Yeah, it's a very good show.
It's such a good show. So I called Alex up to talk about it.
Hello?
Hello, hello.
Oh, wow. You're talking to your microphone, right?
Oh, you can feel it?
Oh, yeah. That's good. That's good.
How's that? How do I sound?
It's good. Oh, my God. It's like late night FM radio, man.
So you're a friend of the show. Last time you were on the show, you were working for a political nonprofit. You were fighting for climate justice.
Oh, yeah.
Now you are an award-winning writer for a critically acclaimed television show.
Yep.
How did that happen? How did you make that jump?
I just went off and I just wrote a screenplay, which I had told you about years ago. And you're like, Alex, you should pursue that. I'm like, nah, man, it's just some dumb idea. You're like, no, you should do that. I was like, nah, I'm doing all this political stuff, man. I'm busy, Billy.
So to back up a second, Alex is someone I met because he sent me a weird email about wanting to buy me a bagel when I worked at Mike.com.
I remember the email.
I brought him in for an interview. He literally had like no experience doing anything, so he didn't get the job. But we've remained friends since, and we'd occasionally collaborate on something or meet up to talk about ideas. And a few years ago, or a little more than a few years ago, we were getting coffee or something like that. And he told me this idea he had for a satire about reparations called Cotton Candy. And the way he described it to me, like, I thought it was really brilliant. I basically told him that I thought he should drop everything else and just write the script for that. But he was busy doing other important activism work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before the pandemic. So fast forward a bit later, after COVID lockdowns, after the George Floyd protest, after the 2020 elections, Alex had left the nonprofit he was working for, and he starts working on writing Cotton Candy. And he ends up getting it in front of some people, and it catches the eye of Shaka King, a filmmaker best known for directing the Fred Hampton biopic Judas and the Black Messiah. And a week later, he had signed a deal to develop the concept for FX.
Wow.
It happened really quickly.
Wow.
But it didn't go anywhere. His original concept, Cotton Candy, was basically eventually turned down. But the work that he did on it was shared with the showrunners for The Bear. And he says he talked to them on the phone for an interview, and they said, can you start tomorrow?
What? This is so magical.
I ended up writing Cotton Candy this spec script. It got seen by some people, got seen by these folks who created The Bear. The Bear was staffing up its writer's room and they felt like that they were missing a certain spice. And, you know, it was a low budget show. It takes place mostly in one location. So it was not seen as the national sensation launching the sex icon of Jeremy Allen White and making chefs the new, you know, sexy beasts of America. Yeah. It was kind of a happy accident. And I was able to sneak in through the side door and, you know, run off with an award along the way, too.
Right. Yeah. You won the WGA Award for Best Comedy Series. Is that correct?
Outstanding Comedy.
And the Writers Guild Award goes to the Writers of The Bear.
And, you know, I remember when they would ask me, Alex, can you go back through this episode and add some jokes? I'd go through the episode. I'd be like, damn, man.
That would really happen? They would be like, can you punch this up?
Can you hey, it feels like this isn't funny enough. Like, can you go, Alex, you're funny. Can you go add some jokes? And I'd go read it. I'd be like, damn, man, this is a depressing show.
Yeah.
What's the basic premise of The Bear?
Okay, you want the Wikipedia synopsis?
Sure.
A young chef from the world of fine dining comes home to Chicago to run his family's Italian beef sandwich shop after the suicide of his older brother, who left behind debts, a rundown kitchen, and an unruly staff.
Comedy.
Right?
Hilarity ensues.
Perfect canvas for comedy. I watched, like, you know, the clip of you all getting the award, and
Renee.
Yeah, one of the other writers, Renee, had a great line. He said,
well, we did it. We finally answered the age-old question. Does comedy have to be funny?
Obviously, he's like addressing a little bit of the elephant in the room that you're like up against shows where like that are jam-packed full of jokes and like that wasn't the show that you worked on.
But I think that's the funniest stuff. I think the funniest stuff is real life. Like, yeah. I think the funniest stuff is when you're so stressed and you're tense and then somebody farts really loudly. Now that's comedy. You know, some of the other comedy writers, they have the quips, they have the quick jokes, but people aren't that funny in real life. But The Bear, that's as funny as real life is, which is just like, it's horrible and it's insane. And in the moment, you feel terrible. But then when you look back, you're just laughing.
It seems like what makes it unique and special is that it's very authentic.
That's it.
Yeah. How much of that comes from the writer's room and your experience and your fellow writer's experience?
You know, nobody really knows any writers in Hollywood. If I asked you to name a famous writer, I mean, unless they are also a director or an actor, it'd be pretty hard. But that's where the characters come from. That's where the stories come from. You know, when you're a Black writer like me, a lot of times they bring you in the room and they want you to add dimension to the Black characters. Now, I wouldn't say I just focus on the Black characters, but that's what's kind of weird about it being such a big, successful show is you pour little pieces of yourself into the characters. That's what defines them. That's what makes them feel more human.
When Alex was working on The Bear, he says he was basically at rock bottom. It was relatively early on in the pandemic. It was the winter. And he was invited to join The Bear's mini room via Zoom from his tiny apartment in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And his heat didn't work. So he kept trying to reach out to his landlord about it, and he wasn't hearing back. And he eventually found out that his landlord died of COVID.
My God.
So he got a space heater that he would keep under his desk, but it would frequently trip the power in his apartment.
Ugh.
So he'd kind of have to figure out how to isolate at the public library often to work on the show.
Jeez.
Like episode 8... I wrote that from a public library. And, you know, at the time, it was horrible. I'm laughing now. But at the time, I was like, this is horrific living conditions. I cannot keep writing a Hollywood show like this.
Yeah.
Now I look back and it's such this big sensation and it's everyone knows who Carmi and Sydney are. It's really funny to me that while it was happening, I was just suffering. But that's what the writer's strike is kind of about. The escapism is... it's kind of concealing what happens behind the curtains, which, like any other industry in this country, is a lot of exploitation, believe it or not.
I think in that that clip I mentioned of you accepting the Outstanding Comedy Award, I think there were like five of you on stage accepting that award, including yourself. How representative is that group of who actually is involved in writing, in the writing process?
Yeah, I mean, there was just two other people. They're the showrunners. So the showrunners are basically in charge of the room. They bring the room together. They structure the room. They're the bosses.
If Chris Storer and Joanna Calla were here, they're in Chicago shooting the second season. If they were here, they'd say something really cool about food and restaurants and the gnarly world and the beauty of it.
So writers usually, you know, writers, especially in TV, because it's such an episodic medium where you have these long character arcs, it's really important for them to be integrated into the production. Now what happens is, yeah, those two showrunners, Chris and Joanna, they couldn't even be there to accept the award because now the showrunners are the only writers on set often. And they have to both write, manage, you know, sometimes direct. You know, they have to run the entire show. And they're also expected to, when a line is not landing, write a new line on the spot. And that's such an all-consuming job. They couldn't even join us on stage to win the highest award in writing, which I'm sure they were very proud to win. People worked their whole careers to win that award. But hey, they had to be in Chicago to shoot season two. So, I mean, it was pretty representative of what that writer's room looked like in season one. Except in season one, I wasn't in person. If it was truly representative, they would have just brought my laptop and I would have been on Zoom and I would have waved. You know, that's more what it was like. Hey.
You're like a little telepresence robot rolling on the stage.
Yeah, totally. That was more my experience.
Again, going back to this clip of you all getting the award, Renee has this other line at the end of the speech where he says,
"We felt so lucky to write this show and it was really hard to get here for all of us. There wasn't like a clear career path for us, and in a lot of ways it felt like we won the lotto to be here, and a lot of ways it feels like we really earned it. So thank you for seeing our work. We really appreciate it."
I'm sure in certain ways that's true, but also in certain ways it's not like winning the lottery.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like winning the lottery, because when you win the lottery, you make lots of money, which I did not do on The Bear.
Right.
I made a very working class income. And then once you divide it up between managers and agents and unions and taxes, I probably would have made more money actually working in the original Beef of Chicagoland.
Right. The restaurant on the show.
The restaurant on the show. So, I mean, it still was unbelievable and surreal the entire time. And it felt more like I won a sweepstakes. You know, it felt like I got cast on Chopped. You ever watch Chopped?
Sure, yeah.
You know, you get there, you have the chance to win money. It's not like $1 billion. I think it's like $25,000. But to do it, you have to like take like a zucchini, just one slice of American cheese and chocolate sauce. And you have to make a like beautiful meal out of it. And you have like 30 minutes. It's so stressful. I mean, it is not just this, you get whisked away to Hollywood, someone's filing your nails. It's work. I interviewed with the showrunners. They said, "Can you start tomorrow?" I get on the Zoom. There's not any, "Oh, here's Alex. Hey, we're going to do a training. Oh, we're going to take it." It's like, no, we're in it. Like, sink or swim.
"Ibra, make sandwiches. Don't stop making fucking sandwiches."
If you watch the show, it's just this crazy kitchen that's moving so fast. And I felt like someone who had just, you know, walked in one day, gotten a job, someone threw me an apron, and they were like, "Cook."
"Yes, chef."
"Tina, fire every single chicken we have, please, okay? Richie, do you even know how to do fries?"
And hey, I have my recipes I cook at home. My friends like it. When I have people over for dinner parties, people enjoy it. But I never cooked that fast, with that much intensity, with that much on the line. And I learned a lot.
I'm doing them in five, basically. I'm gonna order them in
stop.
Five.
Everything,
so.
Fire everything right now.
Okay, I'll fire everything now. I just was finishing
Step
talking
out.
To Marcus and
Step
I-
Step out.
Okay, I'm gonna talk to Marcus.
Step,
I'll
get
order-
the f*** off my Expo, Chef, now!
And it wasn't until honestly, after The Bear came out, after it became successful, I was at a party and I wasn't on Twitter or anything like this. And someone introduced me like, Alex wrote on The Bear. And everyone's like, oh, Carmi's so sexy. Are Carmi and Sydney going to get together? And I just looked around like, wait, what are you talking about? They're like, what do you mean? Like, you're not seeing the memes? I'm like, what memes? Like, what are you talking about? They're like, do you not realize that The Bear is like the biggest show in America?
You're like, oh, I was told this was a small show.
I mean, it's the most watched comedy in FX history after just one season.
Oh, really? Wow.
That's insane. I really don't understand it. It's like really, it's really bizarre, especially when I have like $650 in my bank account and I'm trying to get enough money to go get a coffee.
You know, when I was reading the, I believe it was the New Yorker piece that you were featured in, I got kind of stuck.
What are you guys laughing at?
I believe it was a little magazine called The New Yorker.
You know, when I was reading I believe it was the New Yorker piece that you were featured in, I got kind of stuck on this concept of what they call a mini room.
Oh, yeah.
And this is sort of what I want to dig into a bit.
Billy, I worry about you. I worry about your obsessions, but go on. You found your outlet through this podcast, and I'm glad you found your people.
Well, listen, everyone's talking about AI. Like, I think that's great. I think like the history books are going to show that the Writers Guild of America was on the forefront of fighting for workers' rights in the context of AI.
Yep.
I think that's great. But, you know, I don't know. Whatever. Everyone's already talking about that. Why would I need to talk about it?
Yeah. Let's talk about the nitty gritty weed stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to dig into this because I think it's, to me, it's a perfect example of like people don't actually know what goes on in a writer's room.
Yeah. Definitely. So a mini room is a very insultingly titled way to disrupt worker rights and pay people less. That's all it is. But of course, they find a brand for it. But basically, a couple years ago, 10, 15 years ago, Netflix came to Hollywood with a dream. Put down its suitcase, a dream. I'm going to own fucking everything. That's what Netflix said to itself.
You are the co-founder and CEO of Netflix.
Yeah.
You're like one of those big new media disruptors. Why did the entertainment industry need to be disrupted?
Oh, I think just for the fun of it.
That's like saying some men just want to watch the world burn.
And it had a new model of making movies and TV shows. And part of their model was making high volume of television shows.
My mission is simple. To make you money. Mad Money starts now.
The FANG names, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, were on fire. When asked about what Netflix's principal competition these days was, a seemingly exasperated Hastings just said, sleep! That's right. The idea that the only limiting factor for growth is how much people sleep. I like that, particularly because I don't sleep.
So they invested billions of dollars into making as many television shows as possible, and they sped up the process to make it more efficient. This is what tech companies do.
This year went slow.
This year went slow.
It also kind of went fast.
It also kind of went fast.
When you ask, are you still watching? Well, the answer's always yes. I watched a queen take pills and pawns. I saw a doggy drink Merlot. And sex ed taught me to love myself even when I'm all alone. Yes, I scrolled it all.
So to make it more efficient, now instead of writing a pilot and making a pilot episode and then the execs deciding whether they like it or not, they would just decide, you know what? We don't even need a pilot script. You just come and pitch us an idea. If we like it, we're going to commission a mini room to write the entire season of the show. We'll write all the episodes at once. And if we like it, then we will produce it. And when we produce it, this is what's nice for them. They already have all the episodes written. They don't need the writers anymore. You're basically fired.
What writers like Alex are saying is that mini rooms are sort of a workaround that the media companies have devised in order to pay writers the absolute bare minimum. There is a set minimum rate that has been negotiated by their union, but the timeline is super condensed now.
they make many rooms for shorter time periods than they used to commission writers' rooms in the past. So now you're getting paid for far less time than you used to get paid. For The Bear, I worked on The Bear for 9 weeks. There's 52 weeks in the year. It's pretty difficult to keep living. And unfortunately, I can't pay my landlord in clout. I have to pay them. I have to show that I'm employed somewhere.
The WGA says that for staff writers, what Alex was on The Bear, 98% of them are paid the minimum fee. And that fee is only for a short period of time. For lower and mid-level writers, the employment period for shows that haven't been fully greenlit, like in so many so-called mini rooms, that employment period is only around 14 weeks. For The Bear, Alex says it was 9 weeks. And that's a show that was going well. Others can just feel kind of hopeless or doomed.
I worked on a mini room for Netflix. We wrote an entire season of TV. An entire season. We spent weeks in the room. We talked about so many details. We built characters. We mapped out arcs. We sent it all to Netflix at the end. They said, nah. And that's a whole season of television that just lost. And no one will probably ever see it. But they stockpile these scripts because it's like a bank for them. They don't need to produce it right now, but just like the, you know, real estate companies buy up many houses and the houses just sit there empty, they basically buy up as many scripts as possible to both be able to stockpile the scripts in the event of a strike. They can greenlight these seasons worth of television that we've already written, but no one's ever seen. It's never been greenlit. It's never even been heard of. I'm not even allowed to tell you the name of the show, but it does hurt on an artistic level to know it's just content to these people. Now, the people who have run Hollywood have never been renowned for being good people. They've never been renowned for being humanitarians who care about the artistic process. But they were in the business of making movies. What's really terrible about the six corporations who own 90% of the media industry nowadays, they're simply tech companies. And they look at the entire world, especially the CEOs, like a machine to be improve, to make more efficient. And the way they make more efficient is to remove human beings out of the process, to remove humanity out of the process, and certainly remove any creativity or threat to the status quo out of the process.
We had to lay off a third of the company in 2001.
This is Reed Hastings, co-founder and executive chairman of Netflix, talking at Stanford to a class about blitzscaling, the business practice of rapidly growing a company to be dominant.
After we did this one-third layoff, it was 120 people to 80. We had expected to basically grind to a halt and really not be able to make any improvements because it would take 80 people just to keep the lights on. But in fact, we got more done with only 80 people. And we tried to figure out why, and we realized now there was no dummy proofing necessary. And so it was just everybody was going fast and everything was right. And so we realized with the right density of talent, you know, there's very little process needed, and that was the joyful thing. So at first we said, well, let's do a one-third layoff every year. That was the key.
And that's a long-term winning strategy.
That's a long-term winning. It might be, you know, back to the blitzscaling thing. So.
And the other insidious thing that writers have just begun to worry about is that these tech companies like Netflix have commissioned many rooms to write seasons worth of television shows of many different genres and style to basically feed all of our scripts into an AI machine that just studies all of it and figures out how to do it all without us.
The Bear, you're still obviously very proud of it, it seems,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
It's a great example of something that was able to graduate out of a mini room, but it sounds like a lot is lost to mini rooms.
Yeah.
So what's your experience with that? Or what have you heard from other writers in terms of what is lost to the mini room concept?
It's probably shows like The Bear. There are probably seasons of shows that are like The Bear that are different, that are about a type of person that you don't normally see. There's probably so many lost seasons of television like that. You know, I can speak of my experience in a mini room for Netflix. I can't say the name of it, but it's based on a book. And so it was originally, it's bounced around. HBO tried to produce it. Amazon Prime tried to produce it. Netflix tried to produce it. Each time they assembled a room of really great writers to write an entire season adapting the book. And each time the studio said, we can't produce this. And they let the rights expire, or someone else bought the rights and it went off to another. So there was kind of this gallows humor in the room, knowing that, you know, there had already been months and dozens of writers who had attempted to adapt this, I guess, unadaptable book because of the content of it and the provocative nature of the content.
Since working on The Bear, Alex has moved to LA. And while this new model of mini rooms has meant that he's had the chance to work on multiple projects in his short time in the industry, it has also meant that it's hard to make ends meet. Many writers fear that the only people who will be able to sustain a long-term career in screenwriting with this new mini room model are folks who are independently wealthy or have someone else paying their bills. As for Alex, he says he went to that WGA award ceremony with a negative bank account and a bow tie that he bought on credit.
Before this strike, I gotta say, I've told you a couple weeks ago, I was so depressed. Like, we were gonna do a project. I was just so depressed because I was looking at my finances and I was like, I'm gonna have no way to make money this year because we're about to go on strike. I have a couple $100 left, don't have money for rent. And things have really turned around for me, just my own mental health since the strike, which I could have never expected because a strike means I can't make money. But what I have seen is just such solidarity. I rolled out of bed, went on a popular sports show called the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gotz.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stu Gotz podcast.
Alex O'Keefe is 28 years old, and he wrote for a really great show on FX that was a surprise, that won a lot of awards. The Bear.
I didn't think that it was going to be a life-changing moment in my life, to be honest with you.
Basically, you're having enormous success and you're broke because they're not paying you anything. Like, I cannot believe the details of what
happened.
That
was really mean. Landed mean. It's like
I'm becoming famous for being broke, it feels like. The fans of this one radio show sent me over $20,000 in donations to my Venmo account. And that was never my intention.
Right, off of like what seemed like a very offhanded comment.
Offhanded comment, just as a joke, man. I was just trying to throw out a joke.
Maybe we'll be broke during this strike, but honestly, I was broke working on the television show. So I don't feel like I'm losing out on much right now, okay? I have a Venmo, Alex O'Keefe. You can send me a Venmo.
They were like, no, seriously, give us your handle. And you're like, okay.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, sure.
No, go ahead.
Give it up for real.
Give it up for real.
He's like, oh, I think our fans are going to surprise you. I said, okay, maybe I'll get a coffee. He goes, somebody will send me money for a coffee.
Alex,
thank you.
I think our listeners are going to surprise you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate y'all. Y'all take care. I made as much money going on that show as I made from The Bear after my fees and taxes. That's solidarity for you. That it felt like It's a Wonderful Life.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen screenshots of his Venmo account. It got up over $20,000, just
good God.
Listeners of this show, and to the point where he recorded a video and sent it to them where he's basically like, I promise to pay it forward.
I am so moved and confused. When I showed this to my fiance, they started crying because we have really experienced a lot of stress and depression like so many people.
And so Alex actually set up a website where he compiled a ton of resources and ways for people to actually donate directly to causes related to this fight, including things like the Entertainment Community Fund, Groceries for Writers, Motion Picture and Television Fund, Behind the Scenes Charity, and a bunch of other resources. You can find that at hollywoodstrike.org. So to answer our original question, what's lost to these mini rooms? Halleck basically says more shows like The Bear.
Fully written seasons of shows.
Fully written seasons of shows. I'm sure there are people out there who listen to the show that might have stories of shows that they worked on that they think are really interesting mm-hmm. that should have made it.
Call us.
Yeah, you could talk to us anonymously. I would love to know about those. And I think it's the perfect time to like highlight the kind of work that these writers have done that they're fighting to have better conditions for.
Our voicemail number is 212-994-4882.
Yes, you got it. You got it this time. Wow. Wow. Did you look it up?
Yeah.
I don't even know Liran's number.
Under Understood is Adrian Jeffries, Regina DeLay, John Lago Marcino, and me, Billy Disney. If you have a question that the internet can't answer, we want to hear about it. You can email us at hello@underunderstood.com, or you can leave us a voicemail, 212-994-4882. For more information on the writer's strike, you can go to wgacontract2023.org. That's the official website. There's also hollywoodstrike.org. That's the website that Alex set up. It has some ways you can get involved if you're not a guild member. There are more links to things referenced in this episode in our show notes. We have a website. We have a Patreon. We're bad at social media, but we have that as well. We're in podcast apps. How are you listening to this? Is it in a podcast app? Do your friends have podcast apps on their phones? Could you take their phone and subscribe to us in their podcast app? That could be cool, if they're cool with it. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.